Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a view from Moscow and speak with a Russian journalist who sees a familiar authoritarian leader in Donald Trump and his handling of the American press after covering Vladimir Putin for 12 years. Alexei Kovalev, a Russian journalist who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media on noodleremover.news and has an article at medium.com, a message to my doomed colleagues in the American media, joins us. We will discuss the similarities between these two authoritarian leaders with massive egos and a deep disdain for the press that Putin dominates and controls in his country with ease, while Trump, who was elected with the help of $5 billion worth of free media while spewing contempt for the very media that could not get enough of him, has already reined in the White House press corps while his media spokesperson, Kellyanne Conway, spins the American press daily with breathless doublespeak as she delivers cleverly crafted talking points. Then we will assess yesterday's appearance of Betsy DeVos before the Senate Help Committee and today's confirmation hearings of Scott Pruitt at EPA, Tom Price at HHS, and Nikki Haley as the next U.S. representative to the United Nations. A former special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, David Halpin, joins us to discuss the frenzied effort by Republicans to stop investigations into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. And his latest article at the Huffington Post, Lieberman introducing DeVos, fails to disclose that his law firm represents Trump. Then finally, we will focus on Scott Pruitt's hearing to head up the EPA and the in-your-face insult he represents to all Americans who care about the environment and are concerned about climate change from global warming. Eric Schaefer, the executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project, who was director of the EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, Reject Scott Pruitt for the EPA. And joining us now from Moscow is Alexei Kovalev, who is a Russian journalist who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media on noodleremover.news. He has an article at medium.com, a message to my doomed colleagues in the American media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexei Kovalev.
Hi, Ian.
So your article, I thought, was extremely important because I watched the press conference, needless to say, and Jim Acosta of CNN was abused by President-elect Donald Trump. He couldn't get to ask his question. His organization, CNN, was called fake news by the president-elect, and nobody in the White House press corps stood up for their colleague. They should have demanded that Trump allow him to ask the question before they would take any more questions. But, of course, it's easy for a president, since all of these journalists are so desperate for access, to be able to pit one against the other. But in general, the point that you're making in your article is that you in Russia have been having these phony press conferences with authoritarian leaders with massive egos and a deep disdain for the trade and everything that you hold dear for the last 12 years. So you're basically saying to the American press, welcome to an authoritarian leader.
Well, to be honest, the headline was not mine. It was penned by an American colleague of mine, in an ironic sense. So I don't really think that American media is doomed, because the American media industry is much more sturdier, and it has all kinds of checks and balances in place to preserve the status quo. And unless Donald Trump somehow manages to completely dismantle the foundations of American democracy in his first term, like the First Amendment, I don't think that's a really remote possibility that you'll end up in the same place where we are right now.
No, already, of course, they're talking about moving the press corps out of the White House on the excuse that the room is too small. And that seems like a phony reason, because they don't like having journalists hanging around the White House itself. Donald Trump already doesn't use the Secret Service protection. He has his own bodyguards. He's trying to sort of insulate himself against the rest of the world already. But I think your point is obviously well taken, you know, and to that extent, My sense is that here we are criticizing the American White House press corps for not standing up for their colleague Jim Acosta. But in your world there in Russia, in Moscow, journalists have been murdered. Anna Politkovskaya was murdered on Putin's birthday. So I think there's a fundamental difference, isn't there, between how journalism in Russia is under threat constantly and how journalism here in the United States is under a new threat with America's first authoritarian leader.
You see that Politkovskaya is an extreme example of how press freedom works in Russia, but there is a deeper and it's a much more exhausting process for us, for journalists in Russia, because it's not a flash, it's not an assassination, it's not a gunshot, it's a creeping, taken away all of your little practical freedoms one at a time. So what I'm talking about and what I saw at Trump's press conference and what I'm seeing in the follow-up definitely rings some bells because, well, as I've said in my article, and what I'm seeing now is happening with the moving of the press corps out of the White House, and I think it was Newt Gingrich said
yeah,
we should
it
do
was, it was his idea, yes.
Yeah, that we should be inviting more bloggers and independent publications there. And that's exactly what's happening at these Putin's news conferences, because what you see there, last time it was in December 2016, there were 1,500 people crammed in that room. Not 40, not 200, 1,500 people. All of whom are desperate to ask a question. And only in the course of 4 hours, only 70 or about 70 of them will get to ask a question. So there's one way of controlling one of Putin's ways of of controlling the room and setting his own rules of the game in that he's creating these artificial scarcities that you have to fight for, that you have to jump through an increasing number of hoops to get there, to ask a question. And still, if you get an accreditation and you pass all the security checks, and get a place in the front row, not somewhere out in the back, and you have a flashy enough sign with you to attract attention to your question, because with the when the time comes for asking a question, there's like 1,500 hands going up at the same time,
right.
And you have to work really hard to get them to notice you.
But even if you get a question to Putin, as you point out in your article, a question such as, what about these horrible human rights abuses in our country? And the answer from Putin is, oh, thank you, so-and-so. This is indeed a very serious issue. Everyone must respect the law. And by the way, don't human rights abuses happen in other countries as well? Next question, please. I mean, there is a difference between Trump and Putin in as much as Putin has had more experience with so-called managed democracy, whereas we're just beginning to, the Trump people are trying to create a managed democracy here in the United States. And Trump doesn't have the discipline and temperament of Putin, who is extremely clever. Trump really, genuinely, has very thin skin, and he's likely to fly off the handle with any mild provocation. And he also, even though they both have massive egos, it seems that Trump's ego is much more frail than Putin's.
Yeah, but it comes with experience. I mean, Putin was in his first years. He would also lash out at reporters. His outbursts were quite epic. But I think Trump is a quick learner. I'm sure he'll pick up the intricacies of managing an extremely hostile press. But one thing that he's definitely picking up from Putin is making the reporters fight for your attention, like having them fight not with you, but with each other for the space in the room for your attention. And that's one clever way of distracting them from asking the actual questions. But then there's a question I'm seeing on Twitter more and more these days, and that's exactly the same question me and my colleagues have been asking ourselves each December when the time comes, and it's the media event that outshadows all others. I mean, all the major newsrooms in Moscow are working, are completely focused on this one event, and the day before they are expert analysis and predictions, what kind of questions will be asked, what kind of subject will be covered. Now, on the day of the conference, everybody's live tweeting, and the next day it's analysis of some kind, and articles analyzing, picking apart every Putin's answer. But the truth of it is that it's completely devoid of any substance. You know, no major policy announcements get out on the, at these press conferences. So it's really just a 4-hour one-man show, and we all are just extras in this show, and we are providing a platform for him, an opportunity for him to shine, to show how much of a wise and caring leader he is. And the question we're asking ourselves every time, for all these years I've been covering this. And every time there's a question, someone on Twitter, on Russian Twitter, says, like, guys, do we really have to do this? I mean, why are we wasting so much time on something that's so completely vacuous and just 4 hours of small talk? Because politics, real politics in Russia is not public. You know, the real the most important decisions, they are discussed in the back rooms, and they rarely get announced publicly. And if they are, there's a lot of the problem with news coverage in Russia is not fake news so much as actual news, but devoid of any actual information. So there are career politicians in Russia that do nothing else throughout their decade-long careers but just suggest patently absurd, impossible bills for the sole reason of staying in the headlines. And Putin is the master of that. So he'll talk and talk and talk and for hours, and then at the end of it, you're just thinking, so what was that about? Okay, let me think. Oh, I can't remember a single thing he said.
Now, of course, when you talk about the vacuous nature and that this is a sort of staged event that's totally managed, and the connection there to our press in Washington in particular is that the tendency is to cover the process as opposed to the context and the policy. That's I think, obviously, there's a difference between, the U.S. government is quite considerably more open than the Kremlin, but nevertheless, there is a tendency for it to be all what they call inside baseball, just about process and details and what the leader is doing today and what he's having for lunch, as opposed to what he's doing to the country. So there's a certain familiarity there. But what I detect already in Donald Trump, and I think that what you've had in Russia for some time, is government by stunt. That it's like going back to the days of ancient Rome. It's bread and circuses. You know, Putin pulls off one stunt after the other, and Trump is beginning to pull off these stunts where, you know, a few people's jobs get protected in Indiana, and he makes a big show of it. But at the end of the day, it doesn't amount to anything. So is that an accurate comparison? Have you had government by stunt in Russia?
Oh, yes, definitely. And one problem that we have in Russia is that there is just so much chaff being thrown out to distract you from real issues that are worth covering. And a mainstay of Putin's conferences is people from really small local publications, you know, asking questions that really have nothing to do with the president's office. But it's an opportunity for him to show how much he's a caring leader that knows everything about his country. So there will be people asking questions like, Mr. President, and it's traditional to address him by his name and patronymic, Vladimir Vladimirovich. So we are from this small regional town, and our roads are full of potholes, or the taxes on agricultural, on leasing agricultural equipment are too high. So can you please pressure our local governor to fix the problem? And of course, he'll make a grand gesture, and his aides will rush to write everything down in a notebook, and he'll scold the local governor and tell him to build a new road or freeze the taxes or something. So yeah, there's a lot of this circus stuff that you should probably should expect. And also there will be definitely, as I'm seeing this already, that there will be people in the conference room throwing these softball questions disguised as statements disguised as questions, which are also Putin's favorite. Like it's happened, yeah, it happens at every news conference. There will be a guy who will say something like, okay, that's actually a quite precise approximation. He'll say something like, "Mr. President Vladimir Vladimirovich, do you think the foreign media are unfairly criticizing you for your foreign policy?" And of course, that's an opportunity for Putin to show how humble he is. And he'll say, "Oh, I don't know, maybe they're writing something about me in other articles, but I just don't have the time for that, for reading that stuff, because I have so much to do about the country." So
Right.
that's how it usually, yeah.
Well, he did do a Putin did do a press conference yesterday at a photo opportunity with the leader of Moldova.
Moldavian, yeah.
Yes,
Yeah.
and it gave him an opportunity to defend Donald Trump. And of course, we often talk about the bromance between Trump and Putin. And as you know, there was an intelligence dossier that was leaked recently. It'd been around for some time. A digest of this dossier was briefed to both President Obama and President-elect Trump recently. And that's why the CNN reporter had a clash with Trump, because CNN did not dump the whole dossier, as did BuzzFeed, but it did ask a legitimate news question based upon the fact that the current president of the United States and the incoming president of the United States were both briefed on the contents of this dossier. So therefore, it was news, and that was the question he was trying to ask, and he didn't get the opportunity to ask this question. And then yesterday, Vladimir Putin came to Donald Trump's rescue, but there are still ongoing investigations here in the United States where they're looking into whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin during this election. And that story is not over yet. Trump has done his best, and with help from Putin, to suggest that this dossier is fake news. But, where there's a lot of smoke, eventually you find some fire. But what was the most amazing thing that came from the press conference in defending Donald Trump, Putin said, "Oh, Trump wouldn't go out with low-class hookers or prostitutes. He'd only have high-class women. And by the way, Russian prostitutes are the best in the world." I mean,
Yeah,
could you?
that's his tra yeah that's his trademark. In the same sentence, stigmatizing a minority, like sex workers, or joking about sex trafficking and being really crude and cramming up a really a fratty joke in there. Yeah, he's an expert at appealing to all kinds of to all the segments of the population. So he's a message for everyone. But that's his favorite. I mean, crude jokes, and everybody's laughing. But that's the kind of chaff I'm talking about. Because all the headlines in Russia are about, "Oh, Putin made the joke," while important issues are being underreported. Yeah, so the actual message I have, because there wasn't any real message in my article.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the extraordinary thing is, though, I'm with a left-wing radio network here in the United States. It's about the furthest left media organization, and incidentally, it's going bankrupt. But that's another story. At a
Who
time when,
doesn't?
at a
Who
time,
doesn't?
at a time when you really need somebody to challenge the Trump administration, Pacifica Radio is going out of business. But nevertheless, the mail I get from American leftists is surreal. They reflexively defend Putin. They believe that all of this stuff about Russian meddling in our elections is Cold War propaganda, and that anybody who criticizes Putin is trying to reignite a Cold War. And it's absolutely surreal that the leftists, I don't know whether in the rest of the world, but certainly here in the United States, don't understand that Putin is an incredibly right-wing leader, and he's the worst of American politics, who, you know, these right-wing so-called Christian, gay-hating, God-fearing, Bible-bashing, stigmatizing all kinds of minorities, incredibly racist, all of these horrible things that would disqualify you here in the United States as a leader in the eyes of anybody on the left, and yet they are completely blind to who Putin is in terms of a kind of cult of personality, a sort of neo-fascist strongman with his own youth cult, Nashi, etc. What more evidence do you want about who this guy is? And why do you think the leftists in the West are so blind to understanding who this man is? And by the way, he supports all of the worst right-wing leaders in Europe, and now he's got a buddy in the White House.
You see, the thing about Putin is that he doesn't really have a coherent ideology. So he appears everything anyone on any segment of the political spectrum wants to see in him. So he's equally appealing to the European far right, who see in him quite mistakenly an ally in a struggle, scare quotes, again, the struggle against radical Islam. But Putin is not that. He's not really interested in fighting radical Islam, because we have an entire region in Russia that is controlled by an Islamist thug. You know, it's the most underreported region in Russia, because it's simply off limits to journalists. And but you know, the European right wingers, for some reason or another, out of ignorance or whether it's unintended or willful, they ignore this because they project onto him their own fantasies about a perfect leader. And so do, for example, so many American leftists who are so fundamentally opposed to the American foreign policy, and for good reasons too, that they subscribe to this the enemy of my enemy is my friend logic that's very strong in Russia too. And so it goes on, it's like a feedback loop. Right. So some European far right activist will say something nice about Putin, and Putin will praise him back, and they'll invite him on Russian television, and goes on and on and on, and works the same way with some people on the left. And but Putin doesn't really have like a coherent ideology. You can call him a far right leader, or you can call him far left, and it'll be equally irrelevant.
Well, he is a shapeshifter, right? And that's his advisor, Surkov, introduced him to this kind of idea of shapeshifting. And we're just getting our first taste of it here, too, because Donald Trump is not a traditional politician. He's all over the place. But when you say Putin has no ideology, that's not to say he doesn't have an agenda. And what do you think his agenda is, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy? Just in the last, I know it's a big question, but in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to get your summary on that.
Okay, from my experience, the only agenda Putin and all of his aides and cronies and childhood friends who end up being billionaires, all of a sudden, they only have one agenda in mind: to stay in power for as long as possible and by whatever means necessary, to stay in power and keep their wealth. So that's really the only. If you look closer, if you've been covering Russia for long enough, you'll see that there's really nothing else behind this facade. So they'll say anything and subscribe to whatever ideology is necessary at the moment to achieve that goal, to just stay in power for as long as possible, and that's that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we may have the same thing here, a plutocratic government who are going to cut taxes on the rich so that their fellow billionaires will all get richer, and the Trump brand will be even more valuable, even if he's only lasts one term. So I know it's not the same comparison, but it may be the same sort of cynicism, in the sense that they're using power for personal gain.
Well, yeah, and it's Trump will definitely take a page or two out of Putin's book.
Yeah. Well, Alexei, I really appreciate you joining us. I'm very grateful to you.
Okay, thank you, Ian. That was really interesting.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexei Kovalyov, who is a Russian journalist who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media on noodleremover.news. He has an article at medium.com, a message to my doomed colleagues in the American media, and he joined us by Skype from Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Senate confirmation hearings today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and a counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at the Huffington Post is Lieberman Introducing DeVos Fails to Disclose That His Law Firm Represents Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halpern.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
And what I took away from yesterday's Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee hearings of Betsy DeVos was that the woman's, you know, I wouldn't say she's stupid, but she certainly doesn't know anything about education. She's just got a lot of money, and she spent $200 million giving, you know, money to mostly Republican senators, most of whom were there praising her yesterday. But the one thing that you brought to the table, which I look when I saw Lieberman introducing her, just reminded me of, you know, how come this guy calls himself a Democrat? I mean, he campaigned for John McCain against Barack Obama, and there he is shilling for this woman. But then it turns out that he works for a law firm that represents Trump.
That's right. I mean, Joe Lieberman came in there and did not inform the public, as he lavishly praised Betsy DeVos, the unqualified Trump nominee for Secretary of Education, that his law firm, Cassowitz Benson, has represented Trump for 15 years in a range of matters, including, you know, fights over the debt on his Atlantic City casinos, libel cases, and the threatening letter that Trump sent to the New York Times when the Times published pieces of Trump's tax return. So Joe Lieberman basically became part of the Trump corruption, where they basically money pays for things and then you don't even find out about it. And so, but DeVos herself was a disaster, demonstrated she didn't know quite a bit, many, many fundamental things about education. When she was questioned, she hadn't bothered to study and learn it. She just came in as an entitled donor and hoped that the Republicans on the committee would defend her and protect her, which they did. The chairman of the committee, Lamar Alexander, refused to let the Democratic senators have more than one round of five-minute questions. It was a travesty.
And the subject that we've often discussed, for-profit colleges, I spoke yesterday with Diane Ravitch about it, and she pointed out that, and I said, you know, I don't think Arne Duncan did us much good on that regard. So what do you think she's going to do? And she reminded me that a lot of top people in Arne Duncan's education department, immediately upon leaving the Department of Education, bought shares or joined the company that the holding company for, I think it's called Apollo, isn't it? For
Well, Tony Miller, the number two person in under Arne Duncan, the Deputy Secretary of Education, went to a private equity firm where his partner is President Obama's best friend, Marty Nesbitt. They were brought in by a larger private equity firm to buy the company that owns University of Phoenix, which is getting as much as $4 billion a year from taxpayers and has for its online program a graduation rate of 5%. And so that was more unseemly behavior, but not as bad, not as many of the people who worked for George Bush's education department, one of whom, named Lauren Maddox, who is a lobbyist at the Podesta Group, the mega lobbying firm in Washington, who was there as Betsy DeVos's handler at the hearing. And she has been a registered lobbyist for the predatory for-profit college industry. So that did not bode well. And in fact, when Senator Warren asked Betsy DeVos, what are you going to do? Will you uphold the key regulation, the gainful employment rule that the Obama administration put in that said if schools miserably fail their students and leave them with overwhelming debt year after year, then maybe their federal aid should be taken away? When Senator Warren asked Ms. DeVos, will you enforce that rule? She said, we'll consider whether it's actually having a positive impact, meaning no, meaning this morning all the stocks of the remaining for-profit college companies that are publicly traded shot up dramatically, because it's time again, as Senator Warren said, for crooks and swindlers to have their day and get free money from us taxpayers and ruin students' lives in the process.
And of course, I could never understand. I mean, the first two decisions that Al Gore made when he ran, and I must say there's a certain echo of familiarity with Al Gore's appallingly bad presidential campaign and his refusal to take counsel from the best political operator and strategist that the Democrats have had for decades, Bill Clinton. And by the way, you know, Hillary Clinton, Bill's own wife, didn't take advice from him and lost this last election with the same kind of apparent incompetence. But going back to Gore, his second decision was to concede an election that he'd won when his attorney general in Florida was saying, for God's sake, don't concede. There's going to be an automatic recount, and you won. But nevertheless, he conceded and then had to fight his way back, and thus the famous phrase, sore loser man. But the first guy that he chose, his first executive decision as a president to be, was to choose this Lieberman character, who's turned out to be the worst kind of unctuous turncoat in American political history.
Well, and in 2012, when he was retiring, he vowed he would never be a lobbyist. The next year, he signed up to be a lobbyist for a Libyan politician. And by the way, Al Gore's latest bad decision was to visit Trump Tower to talk climate change with Donald Trump. I mean, maybe he was trying, but the next thing Trump did was appoint Rex Tillerson, who spent 40 years denying climate change for the most part at ExxonMobil, to be Secretary of State. And Tillerson's hearing also a travesty. He said he hadn't studied all these issues. He'd never discussed foreign policy issues like Russia with Donald Trump. And when asked about ExxonMobil, where he spent his entire career and what he did there and whether they engaged in denial of climate change, Tillerson said you'd have to ask ExxonMobil, a totally unsatisfactory answer. But again, the Republicans lined up to defend him, with the exception of Marco Rubio. And I would have to say at this point, while the Republicans, congressional Republicans, so many of them were never Trump people, now they're really pretty much always Trump, or perhaps forever Trump, although that might be the name of Trump's new fragrance. So I'm just appalled at what these Republicans are doing. It is total abdication of responsibility to allow people who are unqualified, didn't even bother to prepare for their hearings, have strong records of being opposed to everything that the agencies they are supposed to be in charge of are trying to do, and you know are often just entitled people who gave a lot to the Republican Party. It is just an appalling, appalling collection of characters for Trump's cabinet, not to mention a White House staff full of people like General Michael Flynn and Stephen Bannon, both of whom were associated with intense bigotry.
Well, let's go through a little bit, if we can, some of the hearings today. Tom Price for Health and Human Services, he's a doctor, Georgia congressman. He's involved in stock trading in companies to do with health care. And, of course, he's an absolutely zealous opponent of Obamacare. Again, a bunch of platitudes, how he really cares about the health of the American people. Wilbur Ross, well, you know, he's a billionaire, and he's at Commerce. Commerce has always been a dumping ground for big political donors.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I don't think that's a big deal one way or the other. Scott Pruitt is a catastrophe. Following this interview with you, David, we're going to have the former director of the EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement on, who has an op-ed in today's New York Times, reject Scott Pruitt for the EPA. And then you've got Nikki Haley for the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And I guess by contrast, she looks like a Nobel Prize winner, right?
I love her. Yeah, no, they. I mean, there's a few people that General Mattis is has his flaws, but he is plausibly qualified for the job. But Scott Pruitt, the one you mentioned, and I don't want to preempt your other guest, it's not just that he's anti-environmental regulation. I mean, that's certainly a Republican staple. It's that he has spent so much time collecting money from the fossil fuel industries to fund, you know, all the work that he does and the associations that he's part of and his campaigns, and then he defends their interests. So it suggests that he's really just for sale.
Well, at this point, he's been bought, and presumably, since he's a Koch brothers protege, it looks like they wrote a check.
Yes, sir.
So,
Tillerson, the other issue besides that he probably cannot put aside his love of fossil fuels as he goes around the world trying to defend U.S. interests, is his perverse, well, in his case, not perverse, his closeness to Russia because it's a place to make money. They were sharing with Russia the fact that they knew the ice was going to melt so that they could drill in the Arctic while they were concealing the severity of global warming from the American people. So that's the wrong person, especially when you have a president who seems to have a bizarre love of Vladimir Putin.
But, David, you don't get it. If the ice melts, then we can drill in the Arctic.
Not bad, Ian. Good job.
So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned, and General Michael Flynn, and of course you served on the National Security Council under President Bill Clinton, were the counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. My understanding is that there's a massive kind of, you know, if there's some sort of panic going on, particularly with Trump and the incoming administration, they're doing everything they can to quash this story about possible, well, certainly, as far as the intelligence community is concerned, the real Russian meddling and the real smoking gun is possible collusion between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign. And apparently there was a FISA warrant issued to the FBI back in October at the recent closed hearing where the House members were trying to get the FBI director Comey to own up to the double standard, where he was all too willing to dump ridiculous, unproven speculation about Hillary Clinton just before the elections, but won't, but seems to be sitting on investigations into Russian meddling. It was a very contentious hearing. I believe that was one of the issues. But so let's start with that. Is it your understanding that, for example, Pompeo, that's going to be coming in, he's going to try and sort of stop everything in terms of looking into this? I mean, one of them, and by the way, when we talked about global warming denial, Pompeo, of all people, who seemed quite reasonable, is also a global warming denier. He denied it in his hearings.
Yep. He's a Koch brothers person.
Right.
He came up through the Kochs in Kansas.
Yeah, but if you're the head of the CIA, the biggest challenge the planet faces is the geopolitical disruption from climate change with massive refugee flows and stuff that we can't even calculate. If the CIA is not looking at that and figuring out how we can deal with it, then we're in big trouble.
That's right. But also, as you say, you know, I think Trump doesn't want to know about this stuff because there might have been collusion, there might have been, and also because he doesn't like anything that undercuts his theory that he's won the greatest landslide of all time. So, and his bizarre love of Russia all figures in. Whether he can get Pompeo and get the CIA to quash this stuff, maybe. It's going to be a little harder in the FBI because the FBI, there are people there with integrity. There are people there that were in the tank for Trump for sure, and that was part of why Comey felt he had to get out that letter before the folks in the FBI who were in for Trump leaked out the information about the Anthony Weiner laptop.
Right, but if you try
to quash the FBI, right, you do it at your peril.
Right, but that's pretty pathetic. In other words, you leak something in order to stop a leak. I mean, that's hardly an excuse for what Comey did.
Well, it would. I think he felt that he would have been then accused of sitting on it for Hillary. So he was probably knew that he was damned either way.
Right.
And so he went with the the always Trump approach, I guess, is what he chose.
Right. So given, though, that Trump himself doesn't know very much and has crazy ideas, you really need somebody. And you were on the National Security Council for a few years there. Surely you need people on that in that position, which is they have to be reality-based. It's where all the crisis information comes through the National Security Council advisor. And instead of having somebody that can, you know, rein in, and in fact, part of the job, as Henry Kissinger exhibited, and so did Al Haig when Nixon got drunk and was rambling about nuking the Russians, part of the job is to save the president from himself. Mike Flynn is the worst possible guy in the world to have in terms of trying to moderate and control Donald Trump.
Absolutely. I mean, Flynn is said that basically Islam is a religion of hate. He retweeted the Pizzagate or related, you know, fake news about child abuse among the Clinton camp. I worked for the National Security Advisor for 3 years. That's the person the president counts on. That's the person who's always going to be the buffer between the president and all kinds of other people. And to have someone so fundamentally unhinged and dishonest and pro-Russia as Michael Flynn is just bizarre.
Why did he make 5 calls to the Russian ambassador just ahead of President Obama freezing assets of one of Putin's closest buddies and issuing some new sanctions? One of the things that I had heard is that Flynn was tipping the Russians off so that Putin's buddy could move his money before it was frozen by Treasury.
Well, that's certainly one nefarious explanation. That would be that, you know, he's trying to help those people, you know, because they're his buddies, and help them to keep their wealth ahead of the sanctions. A more benign but still a very improper thing would have been if Flynn was calling to say, you know, Obama's going to do these sanctions, but maybe don't escalate it, because don't worry, when we come in, we're going to be your pals again. But again, that would be improper, because it would be foreign policy by someone who was not supposed to conduct foreign policy. We're supposed to have one president at a time, and if they wanted to signal that, they could do it publicly, which would still be suspect. But having private conversations with the Russians about anything but pure logistics would be inappropriate. And of course, Flynn lied and said it was about pure logistics. I mean, this is a rogues gallery of people that we haven't even mentioned. You know, the anti-civil rights Jeff Sessions, the the foreclosure king at Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who I went to college with, and the anti-worker and otherwise frightening Andy Puzder for Secretary of Labor. I mean, you've got the amiable dunce Rick Perry at Energy. That we don't have time to even go after that one, because the others are just so horrendous. So basically, I think Trump's cabinet confirms what we've known, what some of us knew before the election, and I think many Trump voters who are communicating with me online are starting to realize now. Trump conned America. He promised he would stand up for workers and stand up for helping people build better lives. And instead, this is just massive kleptocracy, beginning at the top with a man who won't divest himself from his business interests and who constantly mentions how he could have done this deal and he could have done that, and he really should, but he's not gonna, because he wants to, you know, make America great again. But all down the line, you've got people who are conflicted either as donors to Republican senators, or people who took big money from fossil fuel companies and other interests, or people who invested in things that they voted for. This is kleptocracy, government by people trying to enrich themselves. It is hard right Republicanism, as bad as we've ever seen, anti-worker, anti-environment, anti-consumer, with an extra gloss of greed that makes it more like the kleptocratic regimes that we see in Russia and that we saw in Marcos in the Philippines and Mobutu and all the others, Milosevic, who've gotten rich off being president. It is grotesque, and all I can say is we have to massively resist. We have to keep pointing out the facts, make sure we have an independent press, empower the champions who are our senators and representatives and state attorneys general to fight against this. And if we do that, the truth will prevail. We'll have a lot of setbacks, but in 4 years, this maniac will be gone from the White House.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halpern.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back focusing on Scott Pruitt's hearing to head up the EPA.
speak out loud of the things you are proud of. If you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, because the way that it shines may just dwindle with time.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Eric Schaefer, the Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project, who previously served as Director of EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement from 1997 to 2002, where he received a Presidential Rank Award as well as a John Marshall Award from the Justice Department for his leadership in negotiating an industry-wide cleanup of petroleum refineries. He has an op-ed in the New York Times, Reject Scott Pruitt for the EPA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Schaefer.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
And Eric, clearly the Republicans have no intention of rejecting Scott Pruitt, Donald Trump's nominee, to head up the EPA, even though he spent his entire career attacking the EPA, suing the EPA, and sending out, as you point out in your op-ed, press releases bragging about how he's suing the EPA as the Attorney General of Kansas. So what is going on here in the big picture of in so many instances, Donald Trump is putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank? And it's an in-your-face kind of attitude that he seems to be expressing. The Attorney General, who's supposed to protect civil and voting rights, has made it clear that he opposes them. The head of education opposes public education. The head of labor, who's also being questioned today, opposes workers' rights. The head of the EPA, as we're talking about, opposes the work of the EPA itself. And, of course, the Secretary of the Treasury got rich by evicting people from their homes. So is there a bigger signal here in the overall picture of this incoming cabinet?
You stole my thunder when you said Pruitt was an in-your-face appointment. That's exactly how I would describe it. Might help to remind your listeners that during the campaign, Trump did a lot of his own EPA bashing and said at one point his plan was to reduce EPA to little tidbits, and he's picked just the man to do that. As you said earlier, Pruitt's made his career all about EPA bashing. We can't find anything on the other side of the ledger where he's gone after a polluter and gotten them to comply with environmental laws or made them pay a penalty. We can't find anything from his time at Attorney General. He had an environmental enforcement program in the Attorney General's office. He closed it, and he shifted his resources instead to a unit that's all about suing EPA, suing the Obama administration, suing every federal agency, and arguing they have no authority to act or regulate.
Well, there was a very interesting book written by a sociologist, Ali Russell Hochschild, Strangers in Their Own Land. And she spent about 5 years down in Louisiana with Trump supporters to try and understand why people who need the government the most hate the government, and people who are anti-environmental, like Scott Pruitt, but live in the most polluted parts of America. So since you worked for the EPA in the Office of Civil Enforcement as its director, have you ever figured out what you would think that everybody, particularly parents, would want themselves and their children to drink pure, clean water and breathe pure, clean air? So what's the psychology here of this?
Well, you know, that Louisiana story that you cited is interesting, and I read, I think, a review of that work. And I think one thing that came through and in that work, and it's been our experience elsewhere, is that people do care about the environment locally, and including people in oil and gas states, and they can be furious when their groundwater is contaminated or they're inhaling carbon black, as they were from an Oklahoma plant, and nobody's doing anything about it. And when I say furious, I mean that literally. The problem is getting that, you know, very local concern and very local interest mobilized to protect the environment for all communities. You know, our general feeling is everyone has a right to a clean environment. We have national laws to establish minimum standards, and people have a right to claim the protection of those laws. What you see is when they're directly affected, people are angry and they're happy to get the help. And then after that particular incident is dealt with, then, you know, it's harder to hold people together. I think that's a challenge for progressives and for people who want to push back against the Trump agenda.
Well, is this the Trump agenda or is this the Koch brothers' agenda? There's some confusion here.
I don't think they're different. I think, you know, Trump is putting together a billionaire's club of cabinet appointees. Scott Pruitt is not one of those, but he's very much been, you know, the executioner, the handmaiden. Scott Pruitt is not himself, as far as I know, particularly wealthy, but he's certainly serving Koch brothers' interests if you run down the list of actions he's brought against the federal government, not just EPA, but against the administration on health care issues and lots of other areas where he's claiming the federal government has no authority. That is the Koch brothers' agenda. It's a kind of pseudo-libertarianism, and I say that because it's very tilted to serve business interests while claiming to be a kind of libertarian hands-off approach. It's really about protecting business interests, and he's been a, you know, very loud advocate for those.
So then it's no accident that David Koch was in Trump Tower celebrating Trump's victory on election night with Donald Trump and Peter Thiel from the Silicon Valley, the libertarian. But Trump doesn't have any ideology, does he, as far as I can tell?
Who knows what Trump's particular philosophy is? I think the people around him will make a lot of decisions that even Trump, who likes to, you know, send tweets about everything, even Trump is not going to be able to manage the government as though he were managing a lot of hotels and casinos. He's going to have to, you know, let people he picks run things. And he's picking some, you know, alarming people who have a history of pushing only for industry interests and not ever seeing a broader public interest. Now, I can say that about Scott Pruitt. I don't want to go beyond what I know. I've seen the concerns about other nominees, but with Scott Pruitt, there's nothing to suggest any balance in his portfolio when he comes in.
Well, in the last couple of minutes then, Eric Schaefer, let's talk about what can be done. After all, the majority of Americans voted for another candidate, and the majority of Americans surely don't want to see the environment spoiled any further, and they're certainly concerned about global warming. And you've got all these global warming deniers in the Trump administration now.
You sure do.
And you even got the new guy for the CIA. And that's the biggest challenge the CIA has in the future, is to figuring out the geopolitical consequences of global warming, which are going to be manifest with refugee flows, rising oceans, whole countries going under. The portent of a planet in chaos is something that they have to be able to predict and figure out what to do with. And yet the new head of the CIA is a global warming denier. So it's right across the board. It's a very serious issue. But so I guess to get cut to the chase here, Eric, what do we do about it?
So as to Scott Pruitt, you can get to change.org's website and join a petition asking that his nomination to head up the EPA not be approved, that it be voted down. I expect it probably will go through, but it's important to register opposition in the Senate to show that the opposition is significant and to get as good a vote as we can. And that helps to build for the future, because you've kind of, if we get a good vote, even if he gets through, if we get a good vote opposing him, we've established that he's somebody who's going to be watched, and I think it would help to do that. It's a little bit dull to go back to civics, but it's important to let elected representatives know how you feel. Everybody's very busy and, you know, torn different ways by all their different errands. I understand that completely. But you've got to raise your voice. You've got to check in with your congressional office. You've got to check in with your Senate office. Let them know that you care. Let them know that you don't think this guy should be approved and that you're not a supporter of the Trump agenda. Even in a state like California, where I think your state voted heavily against Trump and doesn't support the agenda at all, letting your representatives and senators know means they're more likely to fight for you on those issues. So I hope your listeners will do that.
But just in closing, though, in terms of citizens who want to protect their environment and the health of themselves and their children, is there anywhere we can turn, given that we are facing a dogged, well-heeled enemy who's determined to undo everything we believe in?
Well, first, I think you have to weigh in politically. That's the point I was trying to make earlier, because we need to, you know, change the people who are running things ultimately. But going beyond that, which is, I think, what you're asking, there are laws that allow you to challenge permits, to even bring a citizen suit against a polluter if you see a problem the government isn't responding to. As long as those laws remain intact, you should exercise your right to do that. It's not an easy thing, I realize. It's not something that you can just come home from a hard day's work and, you know, file a lawsuit. I'm not suggesting it's that easy, but you can contact local environmental groups, Natural Resources Defense Council, if you see a problem or you think you're looking at violations in a plant that's in your community. Share that information, make it public where you can, call attention to it. That's important. I think you can definitely take that kind of action. Also, this is a little bit longer term, but the ability to monitor your test, really, your own air and water quality in your own neighborhood, that's gotten actually cheaper and is getting more accessible for average people. You might want to start by calling an environmental group, or if you've got a good local agency, work with them. But some of these instruments can be bought for very little money, and you can use that information to demand action from government. And I think that kind of citizen action is going to be really important.
Well, Eric Schaefer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. You're asking me.
Oh, thank you, Eric. And again, I've been speaking with Eric Schaefer, who's the executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project. He previously served as director of EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes Podcast, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.